Time we derived that the F term potential is minus dW by d phi squared, and I just wanted to show you for the Vesemino model, which is the simplest polynomial, or the most general renormalizable model with a polynomial of one chiral superfield. What the potential looks like. So remember, the way that we get this dW by d phi is just by replacing the superfields with their scalar field components. So strictly, these should be functional derivatives. And I'm just doing the derivative. Right, so for this model, our scalar potential is just lambda plus m phi plus g phi squared over 2 squared. Okay. and remember, we had Yukawa terms, which were minus a half d2w minus d phi squared times psi psi. So, for our Vesemino model, this is just okay. So, I'm going to add. This is just minus a half. Minus a half times m. Psi psi, okay, from the d2w by d phi squared on this acting on the middle term, and then we have a Yukawa term as well, minus a half times g times psi psi. Okay, so we see the fermion mass term, Majorana mass m, is equal to the scalar mass. Well, you get m squared there, but that's the mass squared of that complex scalar. Okay, so we have this scalar potential k, which can be a function, which is a function of all your superfields, real function. And let's just comment on that. So in general, we expand this scalar potential around superfield equals scalar field. And you end up getting terms like in the Lagrangian that look like this, d phi I d phi j star times d nu phi I d nu phi j star. Okay, and this is often written as, this thing is often written as k, I, and then a j with a funny hat to tell you that you've taken the derivative with respect to phi j star. Okay, and this is the Kähler metric. This is a metric on the space, the complex space of fields phi I. So the coordinates, if you imagine some space with coordinates phi I, that's the metric. And it's a complex Kähler manifold. So you'll often, that's a bit of nomenclature really. You'll often hear people talking about that. Okay, so we've got our Lagrangian now for simple chiral superfields. But what about a Lagrangian for vector superfields and gauge interactions in particular? Well, I already told you last time how the Kähler potential gets modified. So if we take, okay, yeah, take a chiral superfield charged under U1 with charge Q, then the Cayley potential is just phi dagger e to the 2qv times phi, and this is the thing that's invariant under phi goes to e to the minus 2iq lambda phi, simultaneously with v going to v plus I lambda minus lambda dagger. Okay, so you can just substitute the new fields into here, and it's pretty obvious that they're invariant. So we have to add kinetic terms for our vector superfield, and we do that using the field strength superfield. So we have a coupling tau, and we have a kinetic part of the Lagrangian, which just looks like tau times W alpha, and we take the F terms. Okay, W alpha, remember, is a chiral superfield. So when we take the F terms of some product of them, then that whole thing will transform into a supersymmetry transformation like a total derivative and give no local physics. And so it will be supersymmetric invariant. So, okay, in general, tau can be some non-trivial function of the fields. But if it's not a constant, the theory is non-renormalizable, but you know there are many theories like that. So we must bear it in mind. Renormalizable. Usually, for renormalizable theories, when it's a constant, the real part of tau is just 1 over the gauge coupling squared. Usually. So for U1 theories, there's a new ingredient which appears in supersymmetry, which you don't normally have in the Lagrangian ingredient. So, and that's the so-called Fayet-Eliopoulos. So it's only in SUSY U1 gauge theories that you can add this term, and you just add the D term of the vector superfield times some coupling psi. So again, the D term transforms like a total derivative, it's invariant under SUSY. And D term doesn't transform into the gauge transformation, and so it's gauge invariant for U1. But not for non-abelian groups. Okay, so let's write down now the full Lagrangian for CZQED, just to summarize everything. So we can imagine that we have several chiral superfields with different charges. So our Kähler potential now we're going to write like that. So we take the D terms of the Kähler potential. We take the F terms of the superpotential. But of course, each of the terms within the superpotential must be group invariant under U1 transformations. Okay, that means the charges of the fields that you put in each term must add to zero. And then we have that where I've just absorbed a gauge coupling into the definition of this field strength tensor. And the Fayet-Eliopoulos term. So we want to work out what that looks like in terms of the component fields that are hidden in these chiral superfields and that vector superfield. So, in terms of component fields, I'm going to work in Vestamino gauge for the vector superfield. Otherwise, you get a million and one terms. So phi dagger e to the 2qv times phi, the d terms of this, you can work out for yourself. It's not too bad. You just multiply the terms out and extract all the pieces proportional to theta, theta, and theta bar. You get f star f. From the chiral superfield, you get kinetic term for the scalar in the chiral superfield. You get some interactions. Well, sorry, this is a kinetic term for the fermion in the chiral superfield. And then we get some interactions between the vector superfield and and the charged fermions. The charged scalars as well. Then we get some interactions between the scalar, the fermion, and the gaugino. So you're probably reeling a bit from what all of these things are. So remember, it's going to be easier if I tell you what's in each field, each superfield. So the charged superfield has a scalar and a fermion and an F term, and V has a gaugino, gauge boson, and D in it. So just to remind you. So, you know, it's half a side of work to get that result. Yep. This is coupling here, yeah. So what I've done is that, yeah, thanks. I should have stressed that more. Normally we have 1 over g squared here for so I'm doing renormalizable case. So normally you have 1 over 4 g squared w alpha, and all I've done is I've redefined w alpha. So let's call these primes. So I've just absorbed a gauge coupling into the field. It's just a normalization. But I mean, you can write a G squared there if you want.
So one of the alpha is going to be
downstairs
as well.
Thanks. Yeah. Okay. So we've got some interactions now. We've got our usual interaction. So this one. Is an interaction between our gauge boson and the fermions. So it's going to have kind of canonical form. This is going to look like, so the final rule is going to be minus IQ times sigma bar mu for that. So, you know, the sigma bar mu is part of a gamma matrix, so it just looks like ordinary QED, that first Feynman rule. And then the other Feynman rules also look like ordinary QED as well. So if we have momentum P going in, this looks like minus Q times P mu. That's ordinary scalar QED. And then if we look at some other term, for example, this one, we have a charged fermion. And its scalar superpartner coupling to a gauge ENO. With a strength of plus root 2 times Q. Okay, so are you familiar with just reading off the Feynman rules from the Lagrangian? Sort of. you multiply by I, right? That's the first rule, because you're really expanding out some path integral with e to the I times the action. So you multiply times I. You write it in momentum space, so each d mu becomes a p mu. So you imagine, you know, you're going to take an annihilation operator. If we look at this first term, operator from this V mu, which is going to annihilate that field here. We're going to create a psi, and we're going to annihilate one, and you know, you just get the rest of the factor left. Sometimes you have to worry about combinatorics, where if you've got identical fields, you can get additional factors, but that's not the case here. Yeah, they vary a little, but yeah. So scalar fields, nearly universally written as a dashed line. Wiggly line gauge boson, well, vector boson. So the only one, and a fermion line with an arrow. Yeah, so these are pretty conventional. The only one that's a little bit, that varies a bit, is this one, the gauge ENO, and, you know, Some people write it like this, some people write it just as a straight arrow line. That varies a bit, but all these are pretty conventional. Yeah?
There should be quartic coupling between the two vector bosons and the scalars as well.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, well, we're going to look at this. The D is an auxiliary field, so this is going to change. But if you just took this term on its own, yeah, I mean, it would... again, just like scalar QED, actually, there's this coupling. And here it's going to look like something like I... Oh, so you should put IQ squared e to mu nu, right? And actually, there's going to be a factor of 2. So here's an example of a field where we can take a factor of 2. Because this, you can take the annihilation operator for this vector field from either one of these. Okay, so there's a factor of 2 involved. And I think it's there, rather than half. I think that's right.
So why is there no factor of 2 from the scalar?
Because the scalars are distinguishable. One of them is a phi star, so it's an anti-scalar, and one of them is a phi. So if you remember, when you expand, if you think about the expansion in terms of annihilation and creation operators, because this is a complex scalar, you know, phi has, you integrate over some momentum, and you have an annihilation operator plus times some stuff, plus... a creation operator which is different times some stuff, okay. Whereas phi star, you have the opposite thing. So they're distinguishable, in other words. Yeah. So we take it, you know, if we're annihilating a phi, we know it has to be this A. It's not a B.
And many people ever write two different diagrams where they switch the Bs or something like that.
Well, this is just a Feynman rule, and all of these things connect to just one point. So actually that's the same thing as this. But I know what you're thinking of. And yeah, when you're doing tree-level matrix elements, so if we could do scalar QED and consider phi phi star going to two vector bosons, for instance, then yes, because you'd have to... You can't... These vector bosons are indistinguishable, so you have to add, if they're in the final state, you have to add the different topology where it's like that. Okay, and you add up all of the different diagrams that can give you a v mu here and a v mu there.
But,
yeah.
But you insist it's the same vertex, we just put a factor of 2?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because you see, the top. Once you put momentum running around this thing has a different topology to that one. Whereas here, it's the same topology; they all just connect to a point. Okay, good. Right. So comments. Again, we've got no cubic terms in V, G, to Vess Zamino gauge. So if you do it in a different gauge, you can get cubic terms, but they're a gauge artifact. When you sum up all the diagrams, you know, the effect of them will go to zero. And we can now write a covariant derivative. For those of you that are really on the ball, you'll notice that for the kinetic terms, we can absorb all of these terms with the vector boson in. These terms just look like the kinetic terms if we replace the partial d's by big d's in the kinetic terms, with big d is d mu plus I V mu, okay? Yeah.
It's a little bit unusual, I think, for me and also for the others, to actually see that by choosing a gauge, you actually get rid of the cubic interaction term.
Yeah, well, it's a supersymmetric gauge. It's not really a U1 gauge.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the SUSY
So the, in a different gauge, the Lagrangian would actually look slightly different.
Yeah.
But the physics would be the same.
The physics has to be the same, because you know that this is just a choice. It's a choice of some gauge, supersymmetric gauge, which is a symmetry of the theory. So it doesn't matter which one you pick.
So does that correspond to some R symmetry, like some mixing of the fields that we have that is not obvious in the component notation, or?
It's the supersymmetry really that.
If I were given two Lagrangians, one was this one, the other one was this one, and I was supposed to quantize things, how would I know that they're the same physical theory?
Yeah, you'd only know from analyzing the symmetry of the theory. Yeah, it wouldn't be obvious to start with,
right,
until you figured out that there's a symmetry. Yeah, that's the magic of both. Gauge theory and, because actually gauge theory, when you add the additional gauge-dependent terms into the Lagrangian, that also looks completely different. But you only know because if you start off with a manifest symmetry, that it won't make any difference physically.
It happens here at the classical level.
Yeah, but it does in gauge theory too. Yeah.
So the gauge-dependent terms, they drop out of the diagrams?
Yeah, what happens is you get additional diagrams with lots of gauge-dependent terms in them, and supposedly magically, all of the gauge-dependent stuff drops out when you calculate physical amplitude. Yeah, this is like the magic of gauge theory or symmetries in general.
Is it like when you dot them with polarization vectors, then they're almost zero?
Sometimes, yeah, but sometimes it's a lot more non-trivial than that. You get cancellations between diagrams. And stuff, yeah.
I have a question. So this, I think I kind of asked about this yesterday, when you talked about gauge invariants, and I'm curious what it is that's actually gauge invariant, or do you impose that you want your symmetry to be supersymmetric gauge invariant? Because obviously we haven't measured supersymmetry, so you can't tell that like something is invariant under a gauge transformation. So.
You impose it.
You impose it, okay.
Yeah, or you write down the theory, which, and then you look at it and you realize, oh, it's got this symmetry to it, and you call that supersymmetric gauge invariance. But it's a very particular form of theory, so really you impose it. Yeah. All you have to do is impose it at the classical. In the Lagrangian, first the classical Lagrangian that you write down, once you've imposed it there, it'll be true for the quantum theory, barring things like anomalies and stuff. If all the interactions and everything preserve the symmetry, then because quantum corrections are made of those interactions, you expect the symmetry just to hold in general. Okay, good. So, we can rewrite. We can rewrite this kinetic term with a big d mu phi, big d mu phi star, and it's going to soak up these terms with v mu's in. Okay, so it's going to look like scalar QED looks when you write it down with covariant derivatives. And I made this comment about the superpotential that only chargeless products of phi I may appear in the superpotential. So this is really us now imposing the U1 symmetry, for instance, because. So let's take an example. So let's say we've got three different chiral superfields, and we put. Some coupling in the superpotential, which looks like this, 2, 3. Okay, and we consider a U1 transformation on these guys. So if these are the charges of each chiral superfield, the only way this term can be invariant is if these charges add up to zero. Okay. And physically that makes sense, because you know you're going to get, when you work out the scalar potential of this thing, you're going to get lots of terms, but one of them is going to be a trilinear term where you annihilate all of these three fields. And we know, if you think of electric charge, you know, you can't create electric charge or annihilate it. That's what the U-1 symmetry tells you. And so if we take an annihilation operator, then the charge of this must be equal to the charge of that plus that. So all the charges must add to zero. Okay, so now we need to look at our W alpha term. And there's like a few lines of work to get this in its final form. But you just, I've given you the form for W alpha. So you just need to multiply the two bits together and extract all the terms proportional to theta theta. And what you'll see is that this thing looks like d squared minus a half f mu nu f mu nu plus 2 I lambda sigma mu d mu lambda bar plus I over 4 f mu nu f mu nu tilde, where f mu nu tilde is defined as epsilon mu nu rho tau f rho tau. So actually, okay, this last term, if you work it out in terms of the derivatives, because each of these f's contains a d mu, the last term is a total derivative. No local physics in it. So we can kind of ignore it for now. Once we integrate over all of space and time from the action, you know, that goes away locally. So in order to derive this, it's not too bad, but you need to find some relation for the trace, or there's a certain trace that you need in V. And what you, if you substitute in for W alpha, you'll end up getting traces like this. And so from the Lorentz structure on the left-hand side, we've got four indices. And under the Lorentz group, there's only a few different terms you can have. You can have an epsilon, four-dimensional epsilon tensor. You can, and then you can have products of two metrics. So mu lambda tau rho. Mu tau lambda rho. Mu rho lambda tau, okay? And actually, you can, by substituting in, you know what these sigma matrices are. So by explicitly substituting them in for various choices of mu, lambda, tau, and rho, you can figure out A, B, C, and D from explicitly trying different values of mu, etc. So this is something that you need in order to derive this expression for W alpha W. Okay, sorry. it's really tricky, and you know, if you don't, well, the homework, that's not too bad. But if you you can spend ages messing about if you don't sort of realise that. Okay. So let's look now at our D terms. So if, again, D is an auxiliary field, it has no kinetic terms. You'll have noticed in our Lagrangian there were no kinetic terms. So we can eliminate it. From the Lagrangian. So if I write, I'm just going to collect now from the Lagrangian all the terms that we had that involved D. And there was a term proportional to phi squared. There was a term proportional to D squared. And there was our phi E Eliopoulos term, psi D. Oops. So the field equations, which we're going to use, again, just like we did with F, we're going to eliminate D. So the derivative with respect to D is 0. So this is Q phi squared plus D plus psi. So D is minus Q phi squared minus psi. So we substitute this back into the Lagrangian. Okay. And, well, do a little bit of collecting of terms, and you'll see that this is minus a half phi squared plus psi squared. So, we have the D term potential for charged scalar fields is just minus this, right? Is a half, it's positive definite. Semi-definite, sorry. Because it's the square of some real quantity. So now the total scalar potential is just the sum of the F-term potential and the D-term potential, which is dW by dphi squared plus a half psi plus Q phi squared squared. And that's also positive semi-definite. Okay, well, some comments. So all I've done is U1. And I don't have time to do the non-abelian extension completely. You can look it up in Balin Love or in the other supersymmetry textbooks. But basically, I can tell you roughly what happens. So now instead of just one... well, okay, there's lots of things that happen. So instead of one lambda in the gauge transformation, lambda becomes lambda A times some generator A, and V also becomes VA times TA. Then each of these VAs has superfields, vector superfields, has a D term, which looks like that. And the scale of the V term potential now goes like a half dA dA. The field strength changes. And we get some extra factors, e to the minus 2 qv d alpha e to the 2 qv. Okay, this basically makes it transform covariantly under a gauge transformation. Alright, and...
So the d alpha is not the same d, it's the covariant derivative?
No, this is the same D as we defined before, but under a gauge transformation, W alpha prime, well, W alpha goes to e to the iq lambda, W alpha e to the minus iq lambda, and if we hadn't put these extra factors in, which we didn't need for U1, this would no longer be the case. Ah, no, that's right. This is the Susie covariant derivative. And this thing is the scalar D, scalar part of vector superfield. Thanks.
And the D bar outside the bracket, that's...
These are also the opposite Susie covariant derivatives. Thanks. Okay, and then, all right, so the transformation of the vector superfield becomes more complicated. It becomes a bit more involved. It basically follows the same thing, but it's more involved. As for U1. So, you can look at the books for that. Oh, and I should point out that the Lagrangian for W alpha becomes a trace over the group indices. Because now this V acquires group indices I and J. And so these matrices, W alpha has some group indices, and so you have to trace over those. And also, the only other thing really that changes for non-abelian is that you have no phi A Eliopoulos term. Because it's no longer group invariant.
The phi Eliopoulos term in the abelian case, does that give rise to a mass of the scalars? Or, because the scalar didn't have a mass before.
Depends on the superpotential, but this gives it, independently of that, it gives it a mass, yeah.
Because if there's only one scalar, then we cannot write down an invariant superpotential.
That's right. So if you have one charged scalar field, then it gets a mass through the phi A, or it can get a mass through phi A Eliopoulos term. That's right. It can also, depending on the sign of this thing, that mass squared might be negative, and so you can trigger symmetry breaking this way. But we'll see that later on. Yeah.
By non-abelian, you mean like n equals higher than 1 supersymmetry?
No, non-abelian group. So okay. Rather than U1, non-abelian, this means SU n, for instance, where n is bigger than 1. Any gauge group that's not U1.
Okay.
So like SE3 or SE2 is done in the O is the same. So now we can actually do something quite neat. And we can write the action as a superspace integral. So with n equals 0 to z, of course, and actually in general, we've been writing the action as d4x times some Lagrangian density. And with Suzy, as you remember, we have the d terms of the k Kähler potential, the f terms of the superpotential, and the gauge kinetic terms. So this thing, instead of writing, remember, we want to extract the coefficient of theta bar, and since d4 theta bar is 1, I can write this thing, this first thing, as d4 theta of k, right? So all of the other terms, through the rules for Grassmann integration, are going to go to 0. It's going to integrate these exactly the theta bits that we want to 1, and we're going to get left with the coefficient. Yeah. It doesn't matter as long as okay. So d4 theta. As long as you write it with, you know, northeast and southeast convention, I gave you the definition before, so you better get that definition. The thing that doesn't matter is if you just move all of these theta bars through the thetas, okay? Because you know, for each one you get to minus one, but if I put the theta bars first, it doesn't matter. But otherwise, yeah, you have to be careful and you use the convention that I gave you a few lectures ago. There's a factor in front of that as well. Okay, and for the F terms, we can extract those by integrating with respect to 2 powers of theta. So often you'll see the Lagrangian or the action written as the superspace integral in that form. It's just equivalent. It's equivalent, of course. All right. So I've just got time to mention to you an interesting fact about supersymmetric theories, which was noticed in the 80s by Witten. And also, it's covered in Weinberg's quantum field theory 3 in more detail. But actually, I think, hopefully, you'll be doing a problem at some stage on this, because it's very cute. And it's not difficult. A particular example of it isn't difficult to see. So it's the non-renormalization theorems. So, okay, what we do is we consider quantum corrections to Suzy theories. And people started noticing that these didn't come, normally when you write a field theory and you do quantum corrections, you get all the terms that are consistent with your original symmetries. Basically, you generate everything at some order of perturbation theory. But they started seeing some strange things. The Kähler potential didn't show any strange behavior. K gets corrected order by order. The gauge kinetic function is corrected only at one loop. I think it did. It's the coefficient of W alpha W alpha. Which is normal for renormalizable theories. Is a constant, right? So this is only at one loop. There are no higher order corrections to that one, turns out. But the really stunning result was that the superpotential, and actually it turned out that the Fayette-Eliopoulos term, not corrected at any order. So this is a kind of quite strong statement. And the original proof used something called supergraph perturbation theory. So this is just like you just generalize Feynman diagrams to include this theta dependence. So we write the actions as superspace integrals, and we kind of take that into account when doing. You develop super Feynman rules by doing that. And what it was noticed was that any radiative correction, any quantum correction to the Lagrangian, may be written as an integral d4 theta times some stuff with no, and the stuff contains no delta functions of theta or theta bar. So immediately from this, once you've shown that, you can see, okay, these quantum corrections are going to correct this Kähler potential bit because it's just d4 theta terms, but there are no terms that look like integral d squared theta. So there are no terms that fit into this superpotential form. So you can look at, if you want to look at a general proof, you're going to have to battle with the notation a bit, but see Weinberg section chapter 27.6. Which shows this kind of for general theories. What you're going to do in the problem is look at a particular theory where you don't have to use these supergraph perturbation techniques. You can just find a couple of symmetries of the superpotential, they're enough to argue this. And it's a very cute, kind of short proof. Along the lines developed by Seiberg in, I think it was 93. It's kind of slick proof. Yeah.
When you're writing the action as a superspace integral over d4 theta, I assume you have to introduce some sort of delta function so you can integrate the d squared theta times integrals become d to the 4 theta integral?
You could write that as a d to the 4 times a delta function, yeah, if you wanted. Yeah. This is over the thetas, right? But you've got plus the Hermitian conjugate, so the Hermitian conjugate would be d2 theta bar w star. Yeah. Or you can just, you know, work this thing out, and then in terms of component fields on this thing, I'll just add the Hermitian conjugate, and look at, you know, afterwards, same thing. Okay, that's probably enough for today. Next time, I'm probably just going to discuss a few generalizations now. I'll talk about what happens to Lagrangian briefly for higher n supersymmetry. Then give you a really brief, a few brief facts about supergravity when you make Suzy local. And then go on to the next big topic, which is about supersymmetry breaking. You're going to have to see how we might break supersymmetry.